The title of the talk I'm going to give today, I tried to deliberately give it a somewhat controversial title. Title is An Extended Mott Transition, the Pseudo-Gap in High-Temperature Superconductors. Even though I'm not really going to say much about the experiments at all, I think as I go on talking about the TJ model, various experiments will naturally occur to people. There is, I think, a great deal of similarity. My collaborators in this work have been Lydia Lingham at Ohio State, Marco Lucchini at Imperial, and Rajiv Singh at Davis. And Lydia was mostly on the thermodynamics, and Rajiv and Marco on the correlation functions, I'll show. What I'm going to talk about today is the TJ model, and I'm not going to say too much more about it than just show you the Hamiltonian. I presume this is an audience of experts on this. The difficulty, of course, in the TJ model is the projection operators. Let me push this up. The projection operators that are in the Hamiltonian are the difficulty. And this leads to problems with analytical computations. It also leads to problems with numerical computations. I'm going to stick to a relatively small range of parameters. J over T will be 0.4 for all the calculations I'm going to do. And the correlation functions will be only at one density. The thermodynamics will be at a range of densities up to 30% doping. So I'll be kind of sticking around these values. The method of calculation I'm going to use, which helps to deal with this projection, is high temperature series. Essentially, in the series generation, we can implement the constraint exactly. So there isn't a problem, at least in generating the series, with having the strong correlation. What this allows us to do, well, first of all, what we get in a high-temperature series is a Taylor series. And we get a Taylor series where what we calculate are these coefficients of powers of beta times one of the coupling constants. These coefficients are exact polynomials. They're, at this stage, there's absolutely no approximation. These are polynomials with rational integer coefficients, and they depend on the density, coupling constants, and for the correlation functions, they'll depend on the wave vectors through the cosines. For the correlation functions, we can achieve with this, because we have the exact polynomial information, we can achieve relatively arbitrary momentum resolution. The data that I'll show for the correlation functions all has a momentum resolution of pi over 50. Okay. Now, this is all very much work in progress. I won't be able to answer all the questions that you might have about the data or other quantities that we haven't calculated yet. But to start with, then, let me show you the punchline, which I believe the data will support, and then we can all argue about whether it does or not. This is, you'll note, I'm not calling this the phase diagram of high TC, I'm calling this the phase diagram of the TJ model. I'll leave it for you to decide whether they're the same. I think they have a great deal of similarity. The axes here are temperature and doping. And what I'm going to argue is that I can find the pseudo-gap behavior in the TJ model through the entropy. There are some really nice experiments by John Lorham's group in Cambridge where they clearly see the pseudo-gap behavior through the entropy. This is something that I can calculate, and I see something that I interpret as showing this pseudo-gap behavior. To investigate this further, we can look at the correlation length, the antiferromagnetic correlation length. And what I believe happens is that the pseudo-gap, what we call the pseudo-gap in high TC, is essentially a crossover where this correlation length is around one lattice spacing. It's not a sharp phase transition, it's just a crossover. Okay. The correlation functions then show us what's happening as we go across this phase diagram. Well, I'm only going to show you one data point on the correlation functions on this phase diagram, somewhere around here. But I believe that you can make a pretty convincing argument that the behavior that we see in the correlation functions there should essentially continue across the whole region. What happens is that the charge and spin degrees of freedom seem to behave very differently. The charge degrees of freedom look like they have well-defined itinerant excitations, like you'd have some sort of surface and momentum space that seems to be relatively well-defined. But they don't seem to be Fermi-like. They seem to be more Bose-like. So I say that they resemble hardcore bosons, and I will try to justify this with some data. The spin degrees of freedom actually are the real anomalous guys here, though. When I think of doping a Mott insulator, I think of going from something like half-filled in the TJ model or the room system, and when I dope, I think of generating some sort of large Fermi surface, doping away from half-filling, where I have low-energy excitations all the way around this Fermi surface. The spin degrees of freedom actually don't do that. The spin degrees of freedom seem to only gradually become itinerant as you increase the doping. They don't form a nice, full Fermi surface immediately. They seem to form arcs centered on the diagonal, which grow as you increase the doping. And it's really this behavior that led to my title of the talk, an extended Mott transition. The spins seem to be becoming itinerant only gradually as you increase the doping. Okay, and there's a couple other things I put on this phase diagram with question marks. And they're on there with question marks because I have absolutely no information as to whether they exist or not in the TJ model. I presume that if you get to large enough doping, you get some sort of Fermi liquid behavior. And I also presume that if you go to low enough temperatures and look at the correlation, the pairing correlations, that you'll see some sign of D-wave superconductivity here, at least enhanced correlations. But I don't have any direct evidence for that yet. We're still working on calculating the pairing correlations, so I don't have any results.
Can we just keep working with the TJ model, very large doping?
No,
because it came from the Hubbard model.
Yeah, there's some real question whether the TJ model is even relevant out here at large doping. Mm-hmm. I agree. And it's also possible that the Fermi liquid phase simply never exists in the TJ model, but it would exist in the Hubbard model, for instance. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. But in terms of critical points, going from this strange metal that you have here to the Fermi liquid, I would say that if there is a critical point, it's out at large doping. It's not somewhere here in the middle of the range. My idea is that essentially the normal state physics is more or less a continuous transition from small doping to overdoping across the whole range of experiments that you can look at.
So you also have no information about the D-wave superconductivity
right.
line? So it could well be that the dome is shifted.
I have no idea if this even exists in the TJ model. I will present some indirect data that I think shows that it probably exists, but I don't have any direct evidence for it. So that's why the question marks are there. I won't really address those points. The data that I'm going to show really addresses the normal state more than the superconducting state. Okay, now the thermodynamics, first of all. How I did this calculation is a little bit technical, so let me go through the steps I went through to get the free energy. What I have are series. I have a high temperature series of 12 terms for the free energy of the TJ model. If I try to extrapolate that directly with Padé approximants, I find that it doesn't behave very well. I can't get to very low temperatures. If I try, the errors just get very large very quickly. So simply extrapolating F of N itself doesn't work very well. The advantage of having these series, though, is that they are exact polynomials. So you can manipulate them as if you had the exact function without any loss of accuracy. There's no numerical round-off problem or anything like that in manipulating these functions. So what I thought to do is try to come up with a different function to extrapolate. And the idea was to try to find something that has as weak a temperature dependence as possible, with the idea that the Padés then would have less work to do and ought to give a better answer at low temperatures. And what I cooked up is the following. I took my free energy, subtracted off some multiple of the antiferromagnetic free energy, the half-filled value. N times F antiferromagnetic, I chose N here because at infinite temperatures I have this kind of term in the free energy. So I'm removing one term from the infinite F sub N, but also this will have temperature dependence in it. what I'm left with has an infinite temperature free energy that looks a lot like spinless fermions. So I chose to form the ratio with the spinless fermion series, where I'm now going to take the energy scale here as an adjustable parameter. And I'm going to play with T star until I get something that extrapolates well with the Padés. And I can then multiply this out because I know exactly what this is at any temperature. And what I'm left with is a result for the free energy at a doping, certain doping or density of electrons, n minus n times the free energy of the antiferromagnet. And the density spacing I chose is 1%. So I've got curves at every 1% doping. Now, this will give me a set of data points. And to do anything with this and get things like the entropy and the chemical potential, I need to do something with these data points that allows me to take derivatives in a sensible manner. And what I've done is a least squares fit to a fourth order polynomial. And to get this as accurate as possible, I've gone through a number of steps. First thing I do is get this basic fit. I'll get a set of coefficients at each density. Then I'll plot the derivative of the ground state energy, essentially, which gives me this quantity, derivative with respect to delta. That gives me mu minus the antiferromagnetic free energy. Plot that versus delta and smooth out the data points. There'll be some noise in the data from just the fact that these are data points that aren't perfectly exact. But if I plot these as a function of delta, I can see where I have the noise in the middle anyways. And that gives me a smooth ground state energy. Take that, hold it fixed, and redo the least squares fit at each density. Then take the next term, the coefficient of t squared, and do the same thing. Plot that versus delta and smooth out the noise in the data. Then take both of these guys, ground state energy and F2, and refit, and that's my final estimate of what the free energy is. Now from this, I can calculate the entropy using a temperature derivative, and chemical potential with one derivative with respect to density, and two derivatives with respect to density gives me the compressibility. Now to get actually back to the absolute values of the chemical potential and entropy, I need the Heisenberg antiferromagnet. But compared to how well we know the doped case, the antiferromagnet is very well known. And to calculate the entropy and the free energy for the antiferromagnet is comparatively easy. You can come up with estimates that are accurate to within a fraction of a percent rather easily. So the real problem is in the doped case is not the Heisenberg piece here that I have to subtract off. And you can actually do quite a bit of analysis even without subtracting off especially the chemical potential. Okay. So that's the procedure I've gone through to get the thermodynamics. And this is the raw data and the fits. I didn't use all the data points to do the fits because the errors grow as I go down to low temperatures. So I used everything that was kind of above this red line. I have to go down to lower temperatures at small dopings because the energy scale for the curves is getting smaller there. If I don't use the points down here, I get very crazy answers. Now, in this sort of calculation where I'm subtracting off the antiferromagnet, half filling corresponds exactly to zero at all temperatures. So that's a very nice sort of thing to compare to. So you get a very nice set of curves. You know exactly what they should be doing. And as you can see, they evolve rather nicely with doping. There isn't a lot of problems. And I do have one check. I had calculated the chemical potential a few years ago at about 20% doping. It turns out at 20% doping, for whatever reason, the Padé gods make it work. And you can get down to relatively low temperatures. And this is a comparison of those data points to these new curves. So here's 20%, 18%, 22% doping. And the data points are from this old calculation. And when I first made this plot, I was amazed that they worked as well as they did.
What is this old calculation based?
It's taking the series for the chemical potential and just doing straight Padé analysis of the chemical potential series. So nothing fancy. And the points agree very well with the curves. So down here, even without the error bars, they're really within a fraction of probably 1 or 2% of each other. And for that in a derivative is pretty amazing, I think. So I was very happy with that result. Okay. Now what do we get for the entropy? Well, first of all, we can look at this coefficient of the linear term in the entropy. This was what I called F2 in my fits. It's really gamma when you look at this at zero temperature. And what we notice, at half filling, this term is exactly zero. The antiferromagnet doesn't have a T-squared term. And it turns on very quickly with doping. And what this fits very well to is actually a square root. A square root will fit that very well. It's a little bit less than square root behavior when you get out to higher doping here, but initially it turns on with a square root behavior. So that's what we find for gamma. Now this is, I think, quite unusual. I wasn't expecting this. And, well, I'll say more about that in a little bit. Now, what I really wanted to do, you know, when I started this calculation, my motivation was to try and find the low temperature entropy, because I strongly suspected that I'd be able to find a pseudo gap in the entropy. So that's the first thing I really was looking for. And this is what I find. Oops. First, let's look just at entropy plotted versus temperature. Now, this is really just the very low tail end of these curves that I made. They only go up to 2/10 of J, so that's about room temperature. The reason I plotted it this way is this is the temperature range that Lorem has data over. His data points go up to about room temperature. And the lowest curve here is the antiferromagnet, so it's rising as T squared. And these other curves are the doped case going from 1% up to about 30% doping. This darker line that's kind of in the middle here is 15% doping. And that's kind of a density where things change the qualitative behavior. Between 15 and 30% doping, there's very little change in the entropy. Below that, there's a rather rapid increase in the entropy. This is just reflecting the square root turn on of gamma. Now the experiments probably don't have these lowest few curves here. This is only 1 or 2% doping. I don't think the experiments reach that small of doping. But what I would say is that this is basically showing pseudo-gap behavior. If you tried to fit a linear term to this higher density data, you'd get an intercept with the axis at a temperature well before zero. So it would look like you had a suppression of the entropy at low temperatures. Okay, so I think that is showing something that looks anyways like the pseudo gap. It shows up even clearer if you plot S over T. This is the same data. The antiferromagnet, again, does not have a linear term at zero temperature. And as you start the doping, the linear term is turning on. And it turns on very quickly. How this turns on, again, is just reflecting the growth in gamma. And again, once you get up to about 15%, this is more or less constant. It's not changing very much, up to 30%. Now, this looks like you've gone through the pseudo gap, essentially, on the underdope side. And then when you reach roughly optimal doping, things are saturating. So it looks really like the pseudo gap only exists on the low doping side. But if you look at the entropy over a wider temperature range, then it looks a little bit different. What we had been looking at was just this little tail end down here. If I look at this now at a temperature up to 2J, we start to see how the entropy saturates at the infinite temperature limit. And also, we see that this really doesn't look terribly linear, even at optimal doping. There's a suppression when you look at this larger energy scale, a real suppression yet of the low temperature entropy. And this, I think, supports the idea that the pseudo gap behavior, which is strongest certainly on the underdope side, is still present in some form all the way up to optimal doping and past, even into the overdoped side of things, when you look on these larger temperature scales. And again, this shows up more clearly if we look at S over T. On the underdoped side, we see the growth in gamma up to about 15%. And this peak at a higher temperature is just growing monotonically as you increase the doping. As you go past 15% doping, this peak starts to come down. This is still growing down here, and this starts to come down. Now, how things are changing in a relative sense, at half filling, this peak height compared to zero is about 0.5. S over T is about 0.5. By the time I reach 15%, it shrunk a little bit in this difference. But if I go all the way up to 30% doping, which is this bottom curve and the top down here, this is still around 0.3. So I still haven't really filled this in completely at low temperatures. I still have a significant suppression of S over T.
Doesn't seem to have any particularly clear value of the pseudocap.
In terms of where this peak is located, yeah, that's true. That's not changing very much. But the data, remember, is only at the very lowest temperature part of this. So comparing this to the data doesn't reach this peak temperature. Okay, so if that is the pseudo-gap, well, what is it? What's happening to the underlying degrees of freedom? We can get some idea by looking at the antiferromagnetic correlation length. And this is something which you can calculate at least a reasonable approximation for it from the Q-dependent spin-spin correlation function, just doing an Ornstein-Zernike type of approximation, where I'm picking off the coefficient of Q squared term, deviation from pi pi. And what I find when I do this is that the correlation length at most dopings is actually pretty small. What I've plotted here are contours. These data points are different values, fixed values of the correlation length. So this is half a lattice spacing, 3/4, 1, 1 1/4, 1 1/2, and 2. And the error bars get pretty large when you get down to lower temperatures here, but the general trend, I think, is apparent. I've also put on this plot the temperature where the uniform susceptibility goes through a maximum. And that follows, at least at small doping, it follows relatively well these contours of constant correlation length. When I get down here at larger doping, it starts to cross these contours. But at least initially, it's following them. This is another way that the experimentalists estimate the position of the pseudogap. They look for a maximum in chi naught. And I would say that this shows that the pseudogap behavior, at least as seen experimentally, we would say is correlates rather well with a correlation length of around 1 or a little bit greater in lattice spacings. I was a little bit surprised by this. I thought it would be larger than that. I thought that I would have like one lattice spacing somewhere out here somewhere, around a half, where I find a half. I think this raises an interesting question, though, and that is, how long of an antiferromagnetic correlation length can you withstand and have an itinerant system? How short does it have to get before you really have a truly, fully itinerant system?
Right. Was it fair to say this is an equal time S of Q?
Yes.
And that it's
yes,
only
very definitely.
Pi of Q level maybe.
It
zero.
Could be different.
One might have a longer.
It could be different. I don't know if it would shift that much. I mean, these are not very large values. I would suspect it would be different if I looked where I was getting larger correlation lengths.
Well, I will call this a strength of singular correlations because it is equal time. Messensity is spanning very large frequency range.
That's certainly
so
true.
There is a strong singlet tendency.
That should show up.
That could be interpretation of it, yes. I can only present the data, and, you know, it's open to many different interpretations.
Lots of cracks in your walls.
As a function of temperature? No, I don't have separate plots of those. Chi-zero is a tricky quantity to get, because anytime a function goes through a maximum and then comes down again, generally the series work up to about the maximum and then have problems. So I can estimate roughly where the maximum is, but to get below that is very difficult. That's a problem we're still working on, trying to find a way to calculate that better. Okay. So that's where I'm going to leave the thermodynamics for the moment. And now what I'd like to do is look at correlation functions at only one point on this phase diagram, unfortunately. And that's going to be right about here.
Is there any meaningful way for me to compare free energies of different buildings to tell whether the free energy of the function of the building is concave or convex upwards?
The free energies essentially were these first curves I showed. These are not quite the exact free energies. They're the free energies minus the anti-ferromagnetic free energy. But these are always concave downward.
No, that's in T.
Yeah. Oh, in density. I don't know. I haven't plotted them that way directly. Oh, yes. I've plotted the ground state energy. And that's certainly always concave upward. Yes. Yeah, so if it did anything else, the system would phase separate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does.
Well, it does it. In the TJ model, it will certainly a larger J over T. There isn't any question about that. At a J over T of around 0.4, it seems to be stable, at least the model. This is a result that I think has been pretty well confirmed by various numerical techniques now. I've found it with the series. Steve has found it with the DMRG. Quite a few groups with the Green's function Monte Carlo have found it. Sandro Sorella, yeah.
It isn't disagreement with Monte.
Yeah, and...
But that's a long story.
That's a very long story, yeah. And if anyone's interested, I'd be happy to talk to them about that afterwards. Okay, so now I only have the correlation functions, unfortunately, at one point on this phase diagram. So using this information to talk about the whole phase diagram is going to be kind of stretching the bounds of credulity, I realize, but I think I can tell a fairly coherent story. If you're using equal time correlation functions to look for the low energy degrees of freedom, probably the first thing you'd want to calculate would be a Fermi surface. But that would be the first thing you'd look for. And one place you can certainly look for that would be in the momentum distribution. This is a momentum distribution for the TJ model. It's plotted in a three-dimensional plot, which unfortunately makes it a little bit hard to see what's going on. Let me point out that this function is really very flat over the whole Brillouin zone. In the center of the zone, it's around 0.6, so around here. Out here around pi 0, it's about 0.4, and in the corners, it's 0.2. So the whole range from zone center to corner is only around 0.4. It doesn't change very much. This has basically the shape that one would prefer from the Arpi's measurements, but it's a little bit difficult to tell from this where exactly the low energy degrees of freedom are, just from looking at this function itself. One way that you can go hunting for those is to look at the temperature derivative of this function, since that will tell you something about the energy.
Do you have like a section plot of this? Because I can't tell from a... Have you plotted it along some direction? What I want to know...
I have. I can do it, but I don't have it with me. But
what I want to know is it always monotonically decreasing, or does it even have...
No, if you were to go, say, out from the zone center here to pi, it's monotonically decreasing. Mm-hmm. It's very flat in here, and then it falls rather steeply in this region, and then becomes rather flat again. If you go out from zone center to pi 0, it's monotonically decreasing, but it doesn't change very much. It only goes from 0.6 to 0.4, so it's a very gentle slope.
And the
sort of like a 15 prime is generated to be start without T prime, right?
Yeah, this is all just the simple TJ model. There's no T prime included. But it looks a lot like there was one, yeah. Okay, the temperature derivative of this guy looks even stranger. Now the fine feature, let me say right away, the fine features that are in this plot are noise. They have nothing to do with even the TJ model. I was going to say reality, but TJ model in particular. In particular, this little feature right here in the zone center is due to this little dimple in the plot. I mean, the temperature derivative is calculated by taking two of these plots and at temperature of 0.2J and 0.4J and just subtracting them at each K point. So it's a very simple-minded way of taking a temperature derivative. There's nothing fancy here. But what it means is that little imperfections in the data show up as huge changes. And there isn't much I can do about that directly. So any of the little features in this plot should not be taken seriously. The big features, though, are strange enough. And the big features are that, now, what I'm looking for is where the low energy occupied states are and the low energy unoccupied states. For the occupied states, I should find that the temperature derivative is negative, because as I raise the temperature, I'm decreasing the occupation of these states. For the unoccupied states, the temperature derivative should be positive, because I'm increasing their occupation as I raise the temperature. Okay. Now, this area that's orange and yellow and kind of light green in the zone center here is negative. That whole area is negative. And those are the low energy occupied states that I'm changing with a little change in temperature. The unoccupied states are these red peaks, which are centered on the zone diagonal. So the unoccupied states really are predominantly on the zone diagonal. That's not something I expected when I did this calculation. The pi zero point is very close to zero. There doesn't seem to be much happening around pi zero. Now, if I were to take a cut along the diagonal, well, maybe like this, and compare that to a calculation for the one-dimensional TJ model, N of K, I would see that the diagonal looks a lot like 1D. These features really look a lot like 1D at the same temperature. It's only when I go over here in the pi zero direction that it looks very different. Okay, so the problem with this is that it really doesn't tell us exactly what the low energy degrees of freedom are. If we had quasi-particles, I would have expected something that looked more like what you get in the tight binding model, where you'd have a nice little strip of width, maybe 2T, around a Fermi surface somewhere. That doesn't seem to be happening here.
And also, what you call as a 1D character is perpendicular to the usual straight 1D character.
Yeah, it's along the diagonal, but that's a good direction for the real materials, because the low energy degrees of freedom in the real materials are along the diagonal. So I would say the diagonal is a nice place to be here. Okay, so can we use some other correlation functions and try to get some more information on the low energy degrees of freedom? Well, the way I thought to do this is to look at the temperature derivatives of the correlation functions. So the spin-spin and density-density correlation functions. You can take the temperature derivatives of those guys. And since this is kind of an unusual quantity to look at, let me first talk about something where we know exactly what's happening. And this is the tight binding and spinless fermion models. We know we have a nice Fermi surface here. Here it's a nice large electron-like Fermi surface. Here it's a hole-like surface. What I see when I take the temperature derivative and plot it as a function of Q for the full Brillouin zone are two main features. I see a very large positive spike at the zone center at Q equals zero. So these are particle hole excitations just across a local Fermi surface. The other thing I see is a negative feature, this orange and yellow line that goes around the Brillouin zone here. This is negative, and it's the location of 2kF folded back into the zone. So these are the 2kF excitations from spanning the Fermi surface. So I clearly see these two different things. They show up as a spike at Q equals zero that's positive, and a curve at 2kF which is negative. And I'm going to use this as my model to look at the TJ model correlation functions. I'm going to look for, in particular, this negative feature, but also I'll say something about what we see at Q equals zero. Now, the reason that these things are positive and negative is easy to work out in terms of convolutions of N of K and the temperature derivative of N of K. And I won't go through that. It's just a matter of following the plus and minus signs. Okay, let me look at the charge degrees of freedom first. This is the basic TJ model charge-charge correlation function at 20% doping. And there aren't any real great surprises in looking at this. The magnitude is 0.2 or less, and this is set completely by the on-site infinite repulsion, so that's not surprising. The one surprise is that the characteristic wave vector where this thing falls towards zero is roughly in the same general area as spinless fermions. It's not the tight binding model. But again, from that, you don't really see much. So let's look at the temperature derivative. The first thing you notice in looking at the temperature derivative is that there's a very large central spike at Q equals zero. So this really does look like the charge degrees of freedom are nicely itinerant. It looks a lot like the non-interacting models in that sense. On this plot, though, the 2kF feature is too shallow to show up very well. So let me plot it a little different way. This is exactly the same data, where now I've truncated this at 0.01. The maximum height of the central spike is 0.08, so I've just chopped that off. And now you can see the 2kF feature where it goes negative, and that's the orange and yellow areas that go around the Brillouin zone here. And this has the symmetry of spinless fermions, the same symmetry in the Brillouin zone. A big difference is that it's much wider in momentum. This is much broader than you'd get for a nice sharp Fermi surface. And this width is not changing very much with temperature. I mean, it's this broad at temperatures of order J, and it stays that broad at temperatures down to 3/10 of J. So it just isn't changing much. If I were to interpret this in terms of some kind of underlying momentum distribution for the charge degrees of freedom, it would look something like this, where I would have essentially the spinless fermion wave vector, but it's smeared out. There isn't a nice sharp surface that's forming, but it would have this symmetry.
Usually if you try to interpret the figure from coming from scattering and some fermion, that fermion surface would
right.
In red.
Right.
Right.
Well, I think it probably is more general than just a real Fermi surface. It's some sort of momentum distribution in the Brillouin zone, where the low energy degrees of freedom are near the surface of that distribution. I don't think you need a real sharp Fermi surface, though, to get this.
What I'm asking is, if this plot at the bottom is another way of seeing the same plot you have on top?
Yeah.
If it's an interpretation?
Oh, it's an interpretation, right? I'm assuming that this is a 2kF feature.
Okay.
And I'm interpreting it in terms of...
corresponding kF.
Yeah, this would be the corresponding kF, yeah. Well, I should put quotes around kF. I don't know if it's... I should really call it that, but... See, that it's essentially that sort of itinerant behavior. Okay. One question about this that is still of interest, are the charge degrees of freedom fermionic or bosonic? From the width here and the fact that this doesn't sharpen up, I would guess that they're probably bosonic. I would expect to get nice sharp features if I were getting fermions. But let's see if we can come up with some better indication of that. This is a plot now in temperature of n of pi pi and n of pi 0. So I'm just fixing Q at one value and looking at the temperature dependence. And what I've put on here are the TJ results, which are the triangles. The solid line is spinless fermions, and the squares are hardcore bosons. These are calculated from a 12th order series for hardcore bosons. Okay, so we have that also. And what we find is that where the spinless fermions are saturating, this temperature, is roughly where the TJ model turns down a little bit, and it's where the hardcore bosons also turn down. And this effect is even stronger if we look at pi 0. Here, all three of these guys, again, are very similar at high temperatures. When you get down to temperatures of around 1.5 to 2J, TJ model and hardcore bosons go off together and spinless fermions are different. So I would say that this is supporting a bosonic interpretation of these degrees of freedom. Though they aren't simply there are no such things as non-interacting hardcore bosons, but clearly this is not, the TJ model is not exactly the same as hardcore bosons. There's some difference.
Some semiotic distribution functions are also available. Maybe you could check that.
Yeah, these are just the ones I had when I made the plots. But certainly other ones should be considered too, I agree. Okay. Now, this is not a trivial thing to find, actually. This is some older data, a slightly different value of J over T, but it shows something I think that's quite interesting. These are different densities now. This is 10% doping, 20, 30, 40, 50% doping. And the solid lines are the spinless fermion density-density correlation at the same temperature as the data points from the TJ model. And if we sit out here and look at pi 0, we see that this is this little bit of a dip that I've been pointing out that makes it look like bosonic. This is largest at 20% doping. It's still present at 30% doping. It's gone by the time you reach 40% doping. So it really only exists over this region where you would like to have a description of high TC. At pi pi, it's much smaller. Yeah, this is a little bit higher temperature than the data I showed before, and it's a smaller effect. There's a little bit of a wiggle here, but it's smaller. It's growing out here because this is becoming close to the Fermi surface in spinless fermions. The data that I was showing before was for this curve right here, and it's a smaller effect than it is at pi zero. Okay, so what I would claim is that the charge degrees of freedom in some sense are doing something that isn't so unusual. They're giving you something that looks like a whole pocket centered around pi pi. And this whole pocket will just change its size as you change the doping. The spin degrees of freedom, on the other hand, this is S of Q itself, a rather ordinary looking S of Q. It doesn't look particularly different than anybody else's S of Q. It's peaked at pi pi, minimum at zero. And this is at large enough doping so that these peaks at pi pi are not diverging. They're only around 1.5. They're not too big. But the temperature derivative of this guy is what looks unusual. The temperature derivative of S of Q, let's look at the three-dimensional plot here. Remember, I was trying to identify the negative feature with the 2kF feature in this behavior. Well, this goes negative about at this light blue line here. That's about where zero is. And it's negative out in the zone corner. And that's the only place it's negative. In particular, it doesn't go negative anywhere in the pi zero direction. This just stays dark blue. It doesn't cross the light blue color line. So if I were trying to interpret this through some kind of underlying momentum distribution of low energy spin excitations, I wouldn't have a surface in the pi zero direction. there just isn't anything happening in that direction for changing the sign. Most likely this stuff out here at pi pi is some convolution of antiferromagnetic excitations at pi pi and itinerant spins in some form. We're probably simply not at low enough temperatures to resolve them. And that's a problem. So the itinerant degrees of freedom make some kind of arcs like this. This is again assuming that there's some kind of underlying momentum distribution here.
But do you also need something in the corner?
Yeah, because pi pi is still the strongest point here in terms of the negative value for this derivative. And I would expect that you still have some kind of antiferromagnetic excitations present. And they would be at a wave vector of pi pi. There's no long range order here. We're quite a ways outside of long range order. There's another thing that's weird about this plot, and that is the q equals zero stuff. Remember that for the charge degrees of freedom, the q equals zero peak was quite sharp. It looked actually rather like the non-interacting models. Here it's a very broad feature, and it doesn't have any sharpness to it at all. It's just a very large blob in the zone center. This looks very much like this, the derivative you'd get at half filling if you were looking at the Heisenberg model. And that's another reason why I believe that there probably are antiferromagnetic excitations present. This resembles the Heisenberg model much more than the itinerant case. So that's the evidence I have for the correlation functions. And what I'd like to finish with is just a few words maybe about what evidence do I have for superconductivity in this model. And let me warn you in advance, it's very tenuous at best. It's not very solid. The first bit of evidence goes back to the peaks in the temperature derivative here in the momentum distribution. These are on the zone diagonal. And if you looked at some kind of heuristic BCS calculation with a D-wave order parameter and you sat on the Fermi surface, you would find that this temperature derivative goes like 1 over the magnitude of delta. So if delta goes to 0, I should get a peak. And that's what I get. Let's see. The other thing that I think favors superconductivity is this guy. This is plotting the hole-hole correlation function in real space. So we're looking at the nearest neighbor hole-hole correlation function. And what I'm comparing to here are my favorite three sets of data. Spinless fermions, hardcore bosons are the squares, and the TJ model are the triangles. And what we see is that the TJ model is roughly halfway in between spinless fermions and the hardcore bosons in this nearest neighbor hole-hole correlation. So this is saying that the holes like to be near each other a little bit more than in the spinless fermion model, and not quite as much as the hardcore bosons. But that's okay. We know the hardcore bosons have a superconducting ground state. So we're going in the right direction. And I think that's the bulk of the information that I have that favors superconductivity. As I warned you, it's kind of slim. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Yes?
Do you have any... I know you've shown us what you have, but what if I were looking for any tendency to strike within the situation
okay.
you have? Are there other things you might ask? Or are there
I think there are better functions to calculate. And this is something that Masao and I are starting to do, and that's to look at the charge susceptibility as a function of wave vector. And we just don't have the data yet. I think that will be much more sensitive to any kind of charge structure. The problem is that where you expect to see something in the charge structure would be on this slope going into Q equals zero. So if you had something like maybe a fluctuating stripe or something like that where you didn't have a real sharp peak and it was somehow broadened out or smeared, it would have to be a shoulder on this slope. And that would be really hard to pick out.
And now you're going to look at what, pi of Q and omega equals zero? Or?
Well, if it were a large wave vector, we could see it, because out here, N of Q is quite flat.
Right.
But if it's somewhere at a smaller wave vector, it would be hard to see using this function.
Okay.
If we look at the charge susceptibility,
yeah,
that doesn't have the constraint of going to zero at Q equals zero. So that will be much more prominent, I guess you'd say, at small q, if there's any kind of peak there.
I just want to make sure. When you say susceptibility, then I'm to think that it's omega equals...
It's the zero frequency q-dependent susceptibility, yeah.
And this is the integral over all frequencies.
Yeah.
Right. This is always equal time.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is static. So this is not the optimal function to look at. And while I can say that we don't see anything here, that's not a real strong statement. So hopefully we'll know some more in the not too distant future.
Is there a technical reason why you can't look at frequency dependence?
Yeah, the way that the high temperature series are generated is you start at infinite temperature, and at that point all states have to be equally probable. And if you're not at the same time, you don't know how to compare your states. So they have to be equal time comparisons. Now, that being said, you can get some information on frequency dependence through frequency moments. The problem with doing that is that it's a lot more work. But in principle, it's possible. It depends upon how hard you want to work.
What temperatures again should we think you go down to?
Okay, I can reach with probably within 5% error about room temperature, about 0.2J for most functions. Now there will be some functions if they have very strong temperature dependence and you can't think of some clever way of setting them up to do the extrapolation, we won't be able to do that well. But for something like the correlation functions or the free energy in particular is a simple enough function that it's constrained by thermodynamics to such a large degree that you can make some guess all the way down to zero temperature, I think. I think that's reliable. The correlation functions are a bit harder, and the susceptibilities generally are harder because they have more possibilities for their temperature dependence. You can't assume anything at low temperatures for the susceptibilities.
The susceptibility, for instance, is a function of temperature. See, at least something that is relevant to the neutron is measurement of finite frequency. In particular, they see these interdimensional peaks.
Yeah. I think the temperature range we can reach again kills us there. The neutron peaks don't show up at very high temperatures, do they? I think they're gone by around 100 Kelvin or so. That's a problem. The question is how big are they when you're around room temperature? And if they're
not
very big, it would be very hard to see. Now, if we could think of some clever way of analyzing the data, maybe we could find some hint for them. But just looking directly at the data, by the time we get down to room temperature in the correlation functions, the errors are already a few percent at best, and probably 5% or maybe a little more at worst, depending upon where you are in the Brillouin zone. And for that reason, we haven't seriously looked for them. If it's a very small feature and we have growing error bars, it's going to be tough to see.
Maybe he claimed that it was not small.
I see. I'd be interested in seeing at what temperatures and how big the peak is. I'm not familiar with.
He'll be here next week, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes. How about the pairing susceptibility? Could you see if there is something
we're,
in the...
We're working on it. We're working on the pairing susceptibility. The problem is the pairing susceptibility is a four-point correlation function. The correlation functions I've shown so far are all two-point correlation functions. And it's just a matter of the four-point correlation function just has a lot more things to be calculated. For instance, I generated, one of my collaborators, I generated a list of all the four-site combinations for the different clusters we have to calculate. This is just simply a list of these different four-point things, and that was 70 megabytes long. So that's a problem. Now, a lot of that will be tossed out eventually because it will be pushed up to higher orders in temperature, and we won't have to calculate it, thank goodness. But still, a significant fraction of it will survive. And
you know what's the effect of this minus a quarter and I and J term? We said sometimes you think.
It will affect things, and it will have a big effect on something like phase separation, for instance. It will certainly move the phase separation line around. There isn't any doubt about that.
You showed us the TJ model. I just not forgotten.
Yeah, basically all of this data is without the 1/4 Ni and J. I have done some analysis of the free energy for particular phase separation, including that term. We have a shorter series with that term. For technical reasons, it makes the generation of the high temperature series harder.
What's a little mean about that term, which I think physically, we know it's there coming out of Hubbard,
right,
along with another three sites,
right,
anyway.
Right.
But somehow it sits, as you know, as a near neighbor attraction.
Yes.
And
yes.
So,
yes, it could be very important for that reason. I agree.
Somehow favors the pairing.
It does. Yes.
Whether you want to think it physically shorter or not, but it's there. And what about three-site? Three-site just makes your life so nasty.
Well,
one doesn't matter.
Again, as in principle, as long as you could write it as an equal time correlation or thermodynamics, in principle, you could calculate it. It's a question of how hard you want to work. And this has been enough effort, right, as is.
These are impressive results you have. They're very beautiful. Particularly somehow that x to the 1/2,
it's quite surprising. There's another little bit of data. Let me just finish with this. I didn't show this because I wasn't sure that this was directly related to the low energy degrees of freedom. But this is the ground state energy plot from this set of data I showed earlier, and trying to decide from this whether or not there's a delta to the 1/2 term in the chemical potential is really, really difficult. The data points here are the points from the raw data, basically. This line is actually 2/5. There are two lines there with these expressions, the only difference being including this delta to the 3/2 power term, which would try give you a delta of the 1/2 in the chemical potential. I should say I only fit the data down to here. So I didn't use these very low density points here. I only fit it down to here. And on this plot, you can't tell the difference between those guys. If you then do the chemical potential, I calculated this two different ways. I did a simple numerical derivative on the data points directly. That's the points here. And then I took the derivative of those 2/5. And again, almost right on top of each other, you can see a little difference here, just a very tiny difference. The only place where there's a significant difference is within 1% doping. The dashed line comes in straight. The square root goes up like this. And remember, I didn't include these points in the fit. So these are really separate points from the fit. And I would say that they favor the square root, but it's really right on the edge of being reasonable. The problem is you don't know where these curves are going to at half filling. That's an unknown quantity. If I knew that the value they were going to was 8.9, then I would say the square root would be strongly favored. But if it's 8.5, then linear looks just as good. And so that's really tough.
What you're saying is that square root may not be real, right? Within the error bars, it could be anything.
From the chemical potential, it's tough to tell. Yeah, I wouldn't commit myself too strongly to either.
But you showed with gamma.
Gamma, it's much stronger because there you know gamma is zero at half filling.
Yeah.
You have a starting point for where it
very
starts from.
Very strong.
Yeah, there isn't much question there. But as Masao and I were talking about just before the seminar, if you assume that these two guys are starting from the same density of states, the way you would get a square root in gamma in 2D is to have a linear dependence on energy. And that linear dependence should also then feed over into a square root in chemical potential. So
is the square root similar to what Masamada has talked about, or do I have a misremembering of that?
No, his he finds essentially just the opposite.
Just the opposite. I knew there was a square root, but I don't remember where it was.
He finds really delta squared.
Thanks.
And I'm not certain as to what the difference is. Why it goes that way. It's Hubbard.
This is Hubbard.
It's Hubbard, but
somehow that might help that both have to choose or one half.
Yeah, you'd hope they'd be the same. One other interesting plot from here, you can push the derivatives one more step and look at the compressibility. And now you can see, of course, a bigger difference between these two fits. But they're relatively the same in this region. They're only, again, different when you go with very small doping. The size of this is not so crazy. This is spinless fermions at half filling right here in these units. So it's about twice that size.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.